since we do all have to leave here at 5:45. I'm Laura Liswood. I am run the Council of Women World Leaders at the Aspen Institute, and I want to welcome you here at this, and we're all very pleased that you could find your way here to this. The council is made up of 35 women who are presidents and prime ministers of their country, and in case you didn't know how many there were. And I'm also the co-founder of the White House Project. It's my great privilege to introduce Koki. I wanted to just put a little context around this whole issue of women as leaders, because I think part of the challenge is to understand why we sometimes struggle with women as leaders. Partly it's because we have lots of myths and archetypes. And the myth and archetype for men is basically the great man hero, and the person who can pull the sword out of the stone, who can change the weather, who can slay enemies.
Let's get them in here.
We need a few of them, right? Yeah. Whose reward is the hand of the fair maiden? And the contrary archetype that we've lived with, which hopefully this panel will indicate is changing, are the myths and archetypes of Cinderella, who's sitting around talking to mice. And Snow White, who at this point is multitasking with seven dwarfs, seven little guys. And Sleeping Beauty, who, if you remember, is unconscious until she gets kissed by the man. So we have these sort of things. But we know real leadership is actually something quite different than that. And, the question also the panel may address is, do women lead differently? But I think that the most powerful part of this panel is what is not only the individual stories you will hear, but what I call the power of the mirror, knowing who it is you can be by who it is you see. And when I met with the president of Iceland, after she'd been president for 8 years in Iceland, she met with children under 8 and found that all the children under 8 thought only a woman could be president. And the boys were really confused as to whether they could be president. But again, it's my privilege to introduce Koki Roberts, whom we know as the senior analyst for NPR and a congressional correspondent, a commentator, a syndicated columnist, an author. But when I look at Koki Roberts, I see something else. I see traits of a leader. She's one who helps us understand the difficult truths. She makes things knowable to us. She puts us in context with the world and what's going on in the world. She has integrity. We trust her. She galvanizes us with her passion and her ideas, all traits of a real leader. But I must say, Koki, my favorite is that you are the author of a book, which is Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation. And if I could take the liberty of summarizing that in one sentence, which to me was, it was a lot of work, but that notion of behind every successful man is a strong woman, I think she also adds, behind every successful woman is an astonished man.
This is Doug. Thank you. I was going with the Cinderella Snow White thing when then you got to the mirror image. Now, fairest of them all. I think it's working, but for me. But they all lived happily ever after. So
true.
Don't forget that part. I'm not going to take a long time introducing this wonderful panel. First of all, because you have bios and most of you know who they are, and we are do have a short time. Sorry to say that Justice O'Connor, who was supposed to be with us, is not. She, first of all, the Aspen Institute's been working her very hard, but secondly, she had ended up being feted at something herself at this hour. I'm really sorry she's not here for a variety of reasons. Obviously, she brings a wonderful perspective. And she was certainly the first. I mean, many of us have been the first woman in the room in a variety of things, but to be the first woman on the Supreme Court is a very different perspective than most of us have. And I wanted somebody older than me on the panel, and these ladies aren't. So I wanted it for two reasons. One, to feel a little better, but also to bring the perspective of the differences over the last 50 years in terms of women in leadership, because I got out of college in 1964. It was legal in June to say, as everybody did, we don't hire women to do that. The help wanted ads were male, female, white, colored, and the Civil Rights Bill passed in July and made that illegal. Now, it took bosses a very long time to catch on to the fact that it was illegal, and it took, at least in my field, very brave women at CBS and Newsweek and the New York Times bringing suit to make a difference. But having the law on your side is something that we really do underestimate. And having Justice O'Connor to talk about that would have been wonderful. But we have been blessed by her at many events during this conference, so we can't really falter for this one. But we have a wonderful group absent Justice O'Connor. You know Senator Susan Collins. She has also been put to much use during this institute. She is a Republican from Maine and chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, which makes her really the voice of anti-terrorism in the United States Senate. And that is a very interesting leadership role to have. Judith Rodin, who is the president of the Rockefeller Foundation and the former president of the University of Pennsylvania. And Beth Brook, who is a chair of vice president for global strategies of Ernst & Young, is that right? Who is also wears lots of other hats there as well as in the nonprofit world, and was in the Clinton White House, where she had the joy of working on health care and other things as well. So I want to start with Senator Collins, because working in a legislative body, and, you know, and Trent Lott has written a book about the Senate called Herding Cats, and that's kind. And working in a legislative body really does require a different set of leadership skills if you're going to do it right. And they are mainly skills of building a consensus. And can you talk about how how you lead by consensus?
First, I want to distinguish between ideology and leadership, because the women of the Senate represent a broad range of philosophies and views, from Barbara Boxer on the left to Kay Bailey Hutchison, or perhaps Elizabeth Dole, on the right. And so I don't want to confuse positions on issues with leadership approaches. They're different. I do believe that the women of the Senate in general try to work together and achieve consensus more than their male counterparts. And I do think that that reflects a different style that women are more likely to bring to leadership roles. It doesn't mean that we agree, it doesn't mean that we bring the same philosophies, but it does mean that we work harder, I believe, than our male counterparts to try to achieve a result, to be less interested in just scoring political points, and instead to try to actually get things done.
Concept.
The women at the Senate get together about every 6 weeks and we have dinner. And we rarely talk about issues. It's an interesting dynamic at these dinners. But one thing that we did take on together was a bill on mammography standards and a bill relating to assistance programs for Afghan women. And we sent out dear colleagues to our male counterparts, that all of the women of the Senate, in one case it was 9 of us at the time, now there's 14, signed. And we got every male of the Senate to co-sponsor. I don't think anyone dared turn down an initiative that was supported by all of the women, the senators. So I think it can be a powerful force. But that's a real difference that I see. I think women, Jane Harman's an example of that in the House. I think women strive harder to get to a goal rather than just score political points.
And you say that you have different perspectives, but even on issues, often you find that you can come together more easily than the guys.
I think that's absolutely true. Again, pointing to my friend Jane Harman, who's in the audience, Jane's obviously a Democrat. She's from California. I'm a Republican from Maine. But we co-authored the intelligence reform bill together. We co-authored a major port security bill together. We're working on a chemical facility security bill together. And unfortunately, those are rare, those kinds of partnerships in the Congress today. But I do think that that is, I'm always hesitant to generalize about women because that too often can lead to stereotypes. But I do think that that is a difference that I've observed in my 10 years in the Senate.
And when you went to become president of the University of Pennsylvania, and this was before women had taken over the Ivy League, it couldn't happen fast enough, but that's a very different kind of position to be in than to be, you know, you're the president, you're the head of the whole thing. Does consensus work then, or is it better to set the agenda and expect people to follow along?
I think in universities are driven by consensus just as a natural set of processes. It is not that universities are not power-based institutions. Presidents lead with moral authority. The faculty, after all, the tenured faculty have all the real power. And so the president is really there to build a consensus around a set of issues, to create momentum for change when change is necessary, and to really mobilize and animate a set of values that represent what is good and important about a university, and to give that particular university a sense of itself and a pride in itself. A woman is a terrific person to do that kind of thing, and it was a long time in coming. I was fortunate to be the first Ivy woman president, and it gave me a platform and a bully pulpit and an ability not only to mobilize Penn to really effect change, but really to get the Ivy League to think about itself in a very different way. I remember walking into my first Ivy League president's meeting, so excited. You know, I was going to be there with all the guys, and this was the Ivy League, and it was so awful. They were so boring and so controlling.
And were they mean to you?
And no, they weren't mean to me. They were so ridiculously authoritarian. It took me a while to figure out how to kind of edge my way into the conversation. But ultimately, with Shirley Tillman at Princeton and Ruth Simmons at Brown, we have certainly taken over the dialogue in the Ivy League. I would say that I think there is no women's leadership style. So business schools now, of course, are teaching group problem solving and consensus as a way of achieving in business, whether people are men or women. But I think women bring to their leadership roles, beyond consensus, a kind of sense of humanity. What you just described as the bills, except for maybe the security bill, but even that perhaps, but the role of Afghan women, health bills, issues that women really recognize and confront. After all, the child leave bills came
all
from
them,
women.
And Susan was talking about, like, Kay Hutchison on the right. She and Barbara Mikulski worked together on what we call spousal IRAs, terrible term, mm-hmm. but, you know, making it possible for women who were not in the paid workforce to be able to contribute to a retirement account.
So I think that's important. I put sharing of jobs when I became president and telecommuting. And I remember when I was at Yale as the first woman chair, and the men were droning on and on. It was a faculty meeting. I had my child in childcare. And they kept saying to me, you're so late, you're so late. You know, we have children too. So the next time you're late, we're going to put Alex out on the street. And I'm watching my watch, and the men are debating some absolutely not very important set of issues. But everybody needed to have their 10-minute speech in order to keep going. And I finally looked at my watch, and I said, I've got to go pick up Alex. This meeting is over. And it transformed my department. The men started going to their kids' soccer games. You know, women in leadership manifest something about humanity that gives men permission, too, to do things that they otherwise haven't.
Also, men meet, women do, you know. I always bring needlepoint to meetings to just sort of get something accomplished. You know? But you could be folding the socks. You could be doing something. You know? Beth, in the corporate sector, how do people view that? You know, one of the things that I've seen of a woman, a corporate leader who's very close to me, told me that her model of consensus building from the men above her, they think that that's namby-pamby and that she's not being a strong enough leader and that she should be out there setting the agenda, and if people don't like it, to hell with them. You know, is that the kind of response you get in the corporate sector?
Oh, not that directly, but by and large, I do think that they see as a sign of strength, this is the way we're going to go. No questions asked. Yeah, there's not a sense of consensus building or inclusiveness. Not a sense of a diverse set of views sitting around the table having discussed it and deciding where they're going to go. It's this is where we're going to go. The most striking thing to me really was going into government, where the accounting profession is historically a fairly male-dominated profession.
It's because girls don't do math.
Yeah. I hadn't actually experienced at that point in my career a very diverse workforce. And going into the government, I'll never forget. You know, within the first couple of weeks, I thought, we're really getting to some great solutions. We're having open debate, open dialogue. And suddenly I realized it was because in the room, there were an awful lot of women who were willing to openly debate and listen to each other, never always agree, but just debate and arrive at consensus. And I think in the corporate world, there is an appearance of consensus. They throw it out there and then they think they've invited viewpoints, but in all honesty, probably haven't done the necessary work to get the buy-in. It's just going to be this way. But by their positional authority, that is possible. I do see a tremendous change, though, happening in the workforce, where there are more women at the table. There is more consensus building. You do get to better answers, and I think in a globalizing world, that is more important than ever, because especially now, as an American woman business leader, when I travel around the world trying to build consensus for decisions to be made, it is very, very difficult given our circumstances today.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Why is that true?
A lot of anti-American sentiment. A lot of views would rather not. If it's an American idea, you have to work awfully hard to make it look non-American. it's just reality right now. So the consensus building skill that I see in women is just incredibly important, and I think will be for the next decade.
When you talk about that, you have to work hard to make it seem non-American. My mother, who many of you know, Lindy Boggs, was a political wife for decades and then a member of Congress herself, and then ambassador to the Vatican, talk about the only woman in the place. although I teased her, she lives on Bourbon Street, she's 90, and I teased her that when she moved from Bourbon Street to the Vatican that the costumes didn't change. Still guys in dresses, Anyway, she accomplished a great deal, as those of you who know her know, but she did it by indirection. And when you're now part of that was the era, that women couldn't just go right out there and say exactly what it was they wanted to get done. But it also worked because, it let other people think it was their idea. It gave people a sense of ownership, all of that. And is that what you're saying you need to do basically in the global world today, that you need to operate by indirection?
Not totally indirection, because I think to walk into circumstances and not have your own view of where you think you're going is a mistake.
No, I'm not saying that.
But yes.
How to
get from here to there very much is a matter of indirection in a lot of circumstances.
I think that totally depends, at least in my dealings with 99 other senators, on the personality of the person that I'm dealing with. For example, I recently reached an agreement on an issue related to Katrina, the hurricane I'm talking about, with a Southern male senator. Whose initials are TL. and it was on an issue about whether or not to take FEMA out of the Department of Homeland Security. And without boring you about the details of the issues, I knew what I had to do was to show him we could keep FEMA within the department, but insulate it and give it protections to protect its budget, to prevent missions from being stripped away by the secretary. Well, all of that was in a bill that I'd introduced with Joe Lieberman. But as I was negotiating with TL, and he kept bringing up these ideas, in each case I said, what a great idea. Yeah.
Right.
What a great idea. because he needed ownership. And he needed to be able to say that he made changes in what I want to do. And that was fine with me.
But
absolutely
see,
fine.
I don't see that as consensus. I see that as a that, great art of negotiation.
No, right. Yeah, it's
right.
a different
that's a
style.
Strategy,
right.
right.
That's why I was saying that I think it depends on whom I'm dealing with. But also, I think it's different in the business world because in the United States Senate, each of us has one vote, and those votes are equal.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
yeah.
chairmen have more authority, but the fact is, each of those votes counts the same, and that's not the case in the corporate world.
Well, when you talk about it, and I throw this to all of you, when you say it depends on whom you're dealing with, do you still find in the year 2006 that there are men who will not follow women bosses, women leaders?
Can I just comment on the last thing, and then I will answer that as well. I'm a psychologist, and the psychological data show that women are more attuned to the emotional responses of the people they're negotiating with. And often that is a disadvantage for women because they allow their emotions to get in the way of the kind of tactics that Susan just described. And so that often does put women at a disadvantage, and women have to, in order to empower themselves, really overcome that pretty well-developed disposition in childhood, and I won't opine about whether it's biological. Yes, I think that there really are still challenges for women in the room. I am very struck, again, observing as a psychologist, how many times in a group conversation a man and a woman will say the same thing, and then a man will acknowledge the comment and refer it to the man who said it and not to the woman who said it.
Absolutely.
You know
it
what happens to me
stunning.
All of the time? What happens to me
too.
All of the time is that I will be standing talking to a group of people. Say I've made a speech, and people are coming up to me after the speech and talking to me, and women will come up and talk to me, and a man will come, and yet she is invisible.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and just come and cut her off and start speaking. Mm-hmm. And that is 2006.
Yep. You know.
The other question, I think, is that you hear still, and it has not been my experience, but we certainly do hear it in the ether, that women make worse bosses and that they are not as good a boss as a man is, especially to other women. Now, that, again, has not been my experience, but I do hear that. Have you experienced that or heard that?
Well, I got a couple of people that work with me in the audience.
We'll call them
right.
I don't
know. I've worked for women bosses and found it to be a great experience, but I also have some great male bosses. So
right.
I haven't encountered that.
Have you, as a psychologist, seen that dynamic?
No, I've seen some great women bosses and some poor ones, but one of the things I have seen, and I'd be interested in everyone's reaction to this, is that, and this is a generational thing, I think the women, many women in the generations that preceded us, those who got higher up, sort of got there in terrific ways, but then they pulled the ladder up
right.
after them.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger women who are in leadership roles are much more conscious of mentoring.
No, I think that's right.
And that is so powerful, and it's such an exquisite cohort difference. And it's very notable. I see it in the university,
right.
but I see it in all the sectors in which I operate.
Well, I do want to turn it open. Say what you're going to say,
but if
people want to start thinking about questions.
I was just going to make a quick comment to follow up on Judy's comment on mentors, because I think role models and mentors are so important. I truly do not believe that Maine would have two women senators today had it not been for Margaret Chase Smith. Margaret Chase Smith was senator the entire time I was growing up. She was senator from Maine from 1949 to 1972. That is powerful. So in my state, neither Olympia Snowe nor I had to prove that a woman could be a senator. That role model was there. she was a successful, powerful woman and who did an extraordinary job. And I just don't think that can be underestimated. And one reason I visit schools in Maine, and I've visited over 130 schools, different schools in Maine, is I want those little girls to see that no matter where you grow up in Maine, you can grow up to be a United States Senator. Because I think that's such a powerful message.
Well, you know, I started this by talking about the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. And the reason that discrimination in employment on the basis of sex stayed in the bill, it was put in the bill as a killer amendment by Howard Smith. So he figured that his colleagues might be crazy enough to vote to end discrimination on the basis of race, but they certainly weren't nuts enough to vote for discrimination, to vote to end discrimination on the basis of sex. So he put it in as a killer. Two women kept it in. Lenore Sullivan, Democrat in the House, Margaret J. Smith, Republican in the Senate, and it went to Johnson's desk with that in it. And I was listening to, with the anniversary of the bill in 2004, I was listening to the Johnson tapes, and the day it passed the House, Jack Brooks called him and said, the bill's passed, it's passed the House. And Johnson says, is there anything in it that's problematic going to the Senate? And Brooks said, oh, there's something about women, but don't worry about that. And of course, it changed the entire landscape, you know, of the workplace.
Absolutely.
You had a question.
Bit of the male bashing that's going on
gentle
right now.
Though,
I know, gentle. But I, my experience, and I wonder, it might be a little bit of Darwinism at play, where the survival of the fittest means that only the fittest women actually rise to the top. And I found in my career, both as an investment banker, and I was at the World Bank as well, that often my biggest and best supporters were the men that I worked with, and it was the women who were the most difficult and who I never had an experience being undermined by a man, but I did by a woman. And I wonder if you guys could comment on that.
Well, and was it generational?
They were all women my age, yes.
They were your age?
Yes.
You know,
in competition?
Peers in competition.
Yeah.
So it was doing what guys do, basically. Investment banking's tough.
It is,
you know.
It is.
It was worse at the World Bank.
Really?
But I hope this isn't read as male bashing because
no.
My husband's in the audience.
I told mine not to come.
not at all. And Susan talked about mentors and role models. Most of my mentors were males. Role models are same gender or you identify with in ways that make them like you and feel like you.
The mirror.
But I think powerful mentors can be of either gender. And I try to say, in fact, that I think there were some pretty tough women during that time. I don't think women are necessarily, I think it's a myth, actually, that women are more competitive with one another than men. I think there's a lot of competition generally, and we are Americans, a very competitive society, and that's why these kinds of leading by consensus really are such important leadership moments, because they actually go against a style of American competition that has gotten us very far. So it's the integration of this new style with something that was effective and still needs to be, I think. But men and women are both developing new ways of being and doing that. I certainly saw it in the undergraduates over the time that I've been in higher education.
Yeah, I agree with Judy. You see it both directions. But I think we look at the women peer group and we judge them. We judge it differently. We expect something different, whereas we expect the competitive behavior from the men. And so we actually judge it perhaps a little more harshly sometimes.
Yeah. Jane.
First, I think everyone needs to know that on the House side of the Capitol, the United States Capitol, there's only one restroom for women. And it's part of a little complex, which is called the Lindy Boggs Room.
It's the only room in the Capitol named for a woman.
And,
we'll
right.
change that.
And it is the place where John Adams or John Quincy Adams expired. But be that as it may.
Because his mother had said, remember the ladies, and they didn't.
Uh-huh. All right. But anyway, this little complex of rooms has the picture of every woman who's ever served in the House, and it fits on a fairly small space, but Lindy Boggs recently received the Distinguished Congressional Medal or something named like that, and she is, everyone thinks so, the gold standard for women who've ever served in Congress. And she was there, and her proud family was there. And it really, you know, when you talk about mentors, it's a big deal. My question is about critical mass. I was talking to Beth about this earlier today. I think it has made a huge difference to have so many women in broadcasting, in legislatures, not a lot as executives in political roles, but more and more as executives in corporate roles and university roles. And I just thought the panel might want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between two women in the Senate and 14 women in the Senate. I mean, what do you... Yes, go ahead, all of you.
I think it makes a big difference. When I first came to the Senate, we had 9 women. We now have 14.
Which was incredible.
Which was a record high.
Barbara Mikulski kept talking about the women of the Senate. It
right.
just cracked us all up.
And we actually wrote a book called 9 and Counting, and we each recounted our own personal stories. And one of my male colleagues, who's a good person, so he shall remain nameless, said that he hoped it really was 91 and holding fast. But we did an addendum once additional women were elected. But it does make a difference. It's the difference that is reflected in the Senate by every committee having at least one woman on it. Now, again, I'm not saying that women vote differently than men, but we bring different life experiences and different perspectives. Just very quickly, I hate to say it, but I agree with the woman who raised the issue of women not supporting other women. And since I'm a dissenting view on that, I didn't want you to think you were alone in thinking that. But I've seen it in the political world. I've seen it when you go to raise money for political campaigns, where women are much more reticent to write those checks, to get involved, to support other women.
But they're reticent to write
it's
checks
changing.
For anybody.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's true.
I mean, I'll tell you just quickly on that question of women in various committees. In the House, for years, of course, there were so few women. I mean, there were never more than 27 until 1992. And there were lots of issues where you really needed a woman in the room. And again, it wasn't that it was that the men didn't care about them. It just wasn't the top priority. Women kept bringing it out from the bottom of the pile and putting it on the top of the pile. And one of those was mammography being covered by Medicare. And a woman lobbyist was working on that. There were no women on the Health Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And she got a male friend. And she was a corporate lobbyist. She was doing this pro bono. And said to him, you've got to take this issue in. It's too important, you know, with losing lives. And he said, I can't do this. I just did the last women's issue in there. They're all going to think I'm soft on women. And she said, just tell them you're a breast man. Worked.
I think there's another way that critical mass is important. When I started, I was a young faculty member at Yale, and it was the first year that Yale admitted women undergraduates, and there were very, very few women on the faculty. And there were very few African-Americans on the faculty. And the women and the African-American faculty members got to know each other very, very well. Because when there's only one or two, and they ask and really want a woman or an African-American on a committee, then you're overutilized. Mm-hmm. And so critical mass really enables people to have fair exposure and not be overutilized when it may be counter to your own professional aspirations to have to serve as the token
right.
woman
right.
in every committee.
Good point. Yes.
I would like to ask something about on the corporate level. I have a similar background, investment banking, International Finance Corporation, which is an affiliate of the World Bank, and working as an executive in a multinational corporation. I had 3 children. And realized that I was up against something that no one talked about. How to manage something that I cherished as well as something that I cherished. And eventually I couldn't do it all and I left and I started my own company. I now work with women executives and they hire me to come in and it's 15 years later and they are sitting with me, and they are dealing with the same issues. They can't. They want to get promoted. They want to be the VP. They want to become in that, you know, hopefully the CEO. And yet, there are no accommodations. Truthfully, you know, I'm not talking politically correctly now. I'm telling you like it is with the corporations that I deal with these fabulously bright women. They don't have mentors. There's no one there. They don't know how to juggle both. And they're told you can't work part-time. You have to, and you know what they do? They work full-time and they sneak out. And that's what I did 15 years ago. I love that the Senate has consensus, and I see in the university world that there's consensus. But I'm wondering if you could help me, help these marvelous women in the corporate world, and how they can go to somebody, a man, who's the CEO, or somebody, to allow them to work less, but still have a prestige, you know, they're what they deserve.
It's such a great question, and it's a very bad environment that they're in. And what I have seen, just in personal experience, is it's a long-term change, but getting the dialogue going with the women in an organization, having a robust dialogue about the circumstances that they feel themselves in, and having the men come into that dialogue and hear it so that they start to understand it, because their context is they have a stay-at-home wife and that is taking care of their children. They cannot relate to the circumstance. Sometimes they don't want to relate. I think a lot of times they just can't relate. It's not their context. And what I have found is when you get women to discuss that issue, bring in the men, the male leadership that is a difficulty, it starts to expose the situation to them in a way that they will start to deal with it. I think we are seeing so much more flexible work environments because those discussions are going on at some companies.
I mean, if you say it hasn't changed that much in 15 years, I have to tell you the change in the 40 years that I've been in the workplace is night and day. You know, there was no such thing as maternity leave, much less paternity leave. Now, I must say the dirty little secret was, it was so great to get back to work. It was so hard at home. So that's why those guys work. Home is hard. It has changed a lot, and that is where I would certainly disagree about women undermining women. I have found that when women get into, particularly mothers, get into leadership positions, that they make a tremendous difference there. And it's been absolutely true in my workplace, and I have seen it in other workplaces as well, because they can then set a tone that says, I'm going to the soccer game now. You know, I had a niece in exactly the same situation as you, one of those other banks connected to the World Bank, three kids. She got a position no woman had ever held. Everybody had stayed till 8 o'clock at night. She didn't, you know? And it suddenly gave everybody else permission not to stay till 8 o'clock at night. You know, there's no need to do that most of the time. And I really do think that if you have a woman who can set the tone for the rest of the organization, but that means putting women in high positions. There's now a woman who is head of the ABC television network, the whole network. On the first day of school for most of the country, I guess the day after Labor Day or whatever, she sent out an email to the entire ABC staff saying, if you are responsible for a child starting school today, and if your supervisor lets you, but see, I would suggest that you take your child to school today before coming to work. Now, she set a tone in that email for the supervisors to understand that they should be saying, okay, take your kid to work.
But the other thing, you know, the men leave at 3 to go watch a soccer
Absolutely.
Game. The key is getting them to say, not to say I'm going to a meeting, but
right.
to say I'm going to my child's soccer game.
And I have seen a huge change there as well, because the fact that the men do it does give permission, or
yeah.
that they go to a teacher-parent conference gives permission for the women to do it. I snuck to all those things. I always said I was at a vote. I think we have time for one more, and then you have to go. Yes.
Let me change the subject a little bit. I'm interested. First of all, my name's Kate Roberts. I'm the founder of YouthAIDS.
I hear that everybody thinks you're our daughter, and I'm very excited.
Oh, I would be honored to be your daughter. My question is about women's empowerment. You're four very powerful women, and you have a lot of rights that other women around the world don't have, and you have a voice, and you have the power of negotiation. And my question to you is, one of the issues that we really face around the world is the fact that I think the statistic is 1% of women in the world actually do have a voice. And I tackle the subject of HIV/AIDS. And unfortunately, a lot of the ways that HIV is contracted is through rape, or really women just not being able to negotiate condom use or even be able to say no. Women just basically don't have any rights around the world. And
the most dangerous place for a woman is marriage in a lot of
exactly.
places. So there you really are stuck.
Yeah, a lot of customs are, you know, it's tradition for men to go and have a drink on the way home from work, visit a prostitute, and then take whatever disease he picks up in the brothel back to his wife. And their wife, of course, doesn't have any grounds at all to negotiate any form of protection. So I guess really I would open the panel to really talk about women's empowerment, and if you have any ideas of how you can empower women.
Okay. I'm going to let that happen, but I also need to tell you all that it is 6:15. So if people want to go grab seats,
yes.
It's the Greenwald Pavilion, and if you want to grab seats,
I can't do it. Why don't we talk afterwards?
And we can talk afterwards. Right? Why don't we just do that?
Okay.
Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you to our wonderful panel. Thanks a million.
Thank you.